First, we'll hear from Ian Lachlan. Ian's one of the three members of APRA, and he has particular responsibility for the life and general insurance industries. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks, Melinda, and good morning to you all. I must say it's great to see so many of you here, and I hope you find the seminar interesting and of value. So let's have a look at, first of all, what we hope to achieve from the seminar. Firstly, we want to help you to better understand our thinking. And that includes giving you insight into the reasons for the decisions that we've made so far. We want to give you an opportunity to ask questions, and we want to help you prepare high-quality submissions in the next round. So with those aims in mind, here's what we plan to cover. So in this session, this first session, we want to cover the major themes from consultation and touch on the process and timetable, and the concurrent sessions that Melinda has just referred to will cover the industry-specific detail. We'll have plenty of time for questions in all of the sessions, and we want to focus on what's important for you. So please make the most of the opportunity to ask questions in the Q&A sessions. Let's do a very quick recap. This process had its origins in 2009 from a range of issues that needed to be addressed. And as Melinda said, the main objectives were to, and it's worth repeating these because it is important to understand what's driving what we're doing. We wanted to improve the risk sensitivity and appropriateness of the capital standards for both general and life insurance. So risk sensitivity, number one. And where appropriate, improve the alignment of capital standards across industry. So that's across life, general and banking. Industry capital levels per se weren't a driver in their own right, but obviously they're affected. The first round of proposals were released in May through to September last year, and the quiz one and first round of consultation closed at the end of October. Now, more recently, we released the response paper, the quite large document, at the end of March, and quiz two, which we decided to do in light of the first round of consultation, is now underway with a due date of 31 July. And, excuse me, those two recent developments are what has led to today's session. Now, the major themes that emerged from the consultation can be divided into these three broad areas. The first is all about capital above the Pillar 1 calculations. So that includes the Pillar 2 supervisory adjustment, the target capital, and ICAP. The next is about the Pillar 1 calculations themselves, and there are a number of issues here: complexity, procyclicality, conservatism. And the third area is transition. I'll now talk about the first of these three areas, the one at the top, and then Helen will address the other two. Now, we understand there's some concern about how we're expecting capital levels to be set and how capital levels should be managed. And there's considerable interest, of course, in Pillar 2 and how it might be administered by APRA. So let me start with the diagram from the response paper, which you will have all seen before, but it's worth looking at again. As part of LAGIC, we're introducing the three pillar concept, or at least we're introducing it to the insurance industry. And to remind you, Pillar 1 is about the quantitative requirements. So the quantitative requirements in relation to required capital, eligible capital, and liability valuations. Pillar 2 is the supervisory review process, which may include a supervisory adjustment to capital. And Pillar 3 is about the disclosure requirements designed to encourage market discipline. Now, it's worth noting that the three-pillar concept is really very well established in the world of regulatory capital. For example, it's used in the Basel banking standards, Solvency II in Europe, and in IAIS standards. IAIS, International Association of Insurance Supervisors. So its membership is made up of organisations like APRA. And indeed, APRA's capital requirements for ADIs, banks, building societies, credit unions, have been based on three pillars for some years. So it's not new for APRA. Now, the PCR on the diagram, the prudential capital requirement, is the outworking of the pillar one quantitative formulaic calculations and the pillar two adjustment process. The first thing to note here is that the PCR is a hard floor. You'll sometimes hear talk of hard floor and soft floors in regulatory capital. Well, this is a hard floor, and it's not to be breached. A breach of PCR will generate immediate and robust intervention by APRA. A breach needs to be corrected quickly to avoid APRA taking serious measures and potentially taking control out of the hands of the board and management. You simply don't want to be there. Let's turn now to Pillar 2 and how it influences PCR. Now, Pillar 2 supervisory adjustment usually will require the insurer to hold a higher level of required capital. So that means that the PCR is more than the Pillar 1 prescribed capital amount. But instead, or perhaps in addition, it may require a greater proportion of high quality capital as eligible capital. Now, I want to try and give you a better understanding of how we will approach Pillar 2. And the starting point is this. You should consider that the LAGIC capital model, for Pillar 1 that is, you should consider that model as being appropriate for a normal going concern insurer, which is well managed, has sound governance, robust and effective risk management, and has a satisfactory ICAP, and I'll come back to that. Now, it follows that if an insurer is materially below this standard, it will be considered for a Pillar 2 adjustment. So it's worth understanding that and remembering it. Well-managed, sound governance, high-quality risk management, and satisfactory ICAP. Now, other factors will contribute to a Pillar 2 assessment. And examples, and these are just examples, of situations where APRA may apply Pillar 2 adjustment include these. The Pillar 2 capital calculation may not adequately address the risks specific to the insurer. For example, the insurer may be exposed to contagion risk. Or other risks not adequately catered for by the standard capital calculations due to some aspect of the insurer's business or operations. It may be that the expected growth is not adequately reflected in target capital. It may be that the business strategy is changing significantly, introducing uncertainty and risk. And it may be that the company has an unusually risky business model. So any of those, and I stress they're just examples, may ask us or lead to us asking if a Pillar 2 adjustment is required. Now, much of what I've just been talking about will be captured in an institution's PAIRS assessment. However, the PAIRS, so that's our rating system that we apply when we review an organisation. However, the PAIRS rating is only a broad indicator of likely Pillar 2 content. So a normal rating is far less likely to merit a Pillar 2 adjustment than an entity in mandated improvement, for example. But a lot of organisations are in oversight. But a rating of oversight would certainly not automatically mean a Pillar 2 adjustment. Rather, it would depend on the reason for the oversight rating. And in particular, large doesn't necessarily mean Pillar 2 adjustment. Now, a thing to note here, and again, it's really worth stressing this, A thing to note here is that the Pillar 2 outcome ultimately is largely in the insurer's hands. So all of the things that I've been talking about are capable of being managed by the insurer. Here are a few other points about Pillar 2. The Pillar 2 assessment will be based on the full range of APRA's supervision activities. So that includes things like off-site analysis, on-site reviews, a review of the ICAP, and any other information that APRA is aware of. The process for determining any Pillar 2 adjustment will usually involve significant dialogue between the insurer and APRA as part of our usual supervision process and activities. The basis for any Pillar 2 adjustment will be transparent to the relevant insurer in the form of the reasons and factors that led to the adjustment. And depending on the basis for the adjustment, APRA may seek to have the insurer address the area of concern through, for example, changes to its operations, governance, or risk and capital management framework, or perhaps processes. And where identified issues can be satisfactorily addressed in a reasonably short time frame, APRA may choose not to apply a Pillar 2 adjustment. It will be clear to the insurer what sort of action is required to address the issues leading to the Pillar 2 adjustment, which, if undertaken to APRA's satisfaction, will lead to its reduction or its removal. And the process for determining any Pillar 2 adjustment will be subject to specific and disciplined governance arrangements within APRA. And these arrangements are already in place for ADIs. And it's worth noting that the process will include review at APRA senior management level. So this is not a trivial exercise by any means. And lastly, it's worth making the point explicitly that Pillar 2 is not a tool for APRA to lift industry capital levels via the back door. That is, we're not going to use it as a de facto way of lifting Pillar 1 requirements. Adjustments will be deliberately targeted at those who need them. Okay, let's move now from Pillar 2 to target capital and ICAP. So as its name suggests, ICAP is a process, but of course we are interested in both the process and its effective management. That is, we're interested in the outcomes of the process. So you have the process itself, which we're very interested in. We're also interested in the outcomes. Above PCR, APRA expects an insurer to set its target capital based on its ICAP. And target capital is meant to be a target and not another threshold. So at times, actual capital may drop below target position, and this is quite acceptable as long as the situation is addressed by the ICAP and managed accordingly. So if it's clearly within the scope of the ICAP and it's being managed properly, then we shouldn't be greatly surprised if capital is below target in some circumstances. You'll see on the earlier diagram, that's the colourful diagram, you'll see that APRA's level of supervision will become more intense as the capital position approaches PCR. So as it falls, we'll take a closer and closer interest. So the big questions are, where should target capital be set and how will capital be managed when it falls below the target position? ICAP formalises the existing expectations that insurers have in place a process to assess their capital needs and manage their capital levels. In particular, we want insurers to assess their own risk profile and the capital needed to support the risks they undertake and to carry out capital projections and stress testing. The ICAP must set out the process for board and management oversight, assessment of risks, assessing the capital needed in the context of the risks and the risk appetite, the organisation's risk appetite, setting a target capital policy that reflects that assessment, managing capital in accordance with the policy, with the plan, and monitoring, reporting, and review. The ICAP should also include trigger points and the actions that the insurer will take when those trigger points are reached. And that needs to include trigger points for reporting or engaging with APRA. The insurer should manage its capital position level in accordance with those trigger points and actions. And target capital levels should be set to reflect the insurer's risk appetite. And some of you will have heard me talk about risk appetite in the past, and you'll hear me talk about it again in the future. It's critically important. It sets the foundation. And target capital can be a single target capital, a single target level or a range. The target capital needs to ensure that the insurer will operate at capital levels above APRA's minimum requirements, that is the PCR, in accordance with the insurer's risk appetite, but should not be set solely by reference to these minimum requirements. We expect all of this to be supported by appropriate analysis and an understanding of the financial dynamics of the business. For larger companies, we would expect this work to be quite sophisticated, with use of comprehensive modelling and so on. For smaller companies, we would expect that simpler tools would often be used. These would be based on an analysis and understanding of the major risks in the business and how they are managed. A few other points on ICAP. It differs from the financial condition report. It's not the same thing. The FCR will continue to be fundamentally important for the board and for APRA. The ICAP must be subject to periodic review by the insurer, so you can't just put it in the bottom drawer. The insurer must manage its capital in accordance with its ICAP on a continuous basis. The insurer will be required to submit to APRA annually a report on their ICAP and, in particular, its outcomes. And this must, at a minimum, include sufficiently detailed information on the insurer's current and projected actual capital levels relative to target levels for at least a 3-year period. And it should also articulate any changes in the ICAP, that is, changes in the process. So, ICAP and target capital, a job for the actuary, the CFO, or someone else? Well, both the actuary and the CFO should have a lot of input. But ultimately, the ICAP and target capital need to be owned by senior management, the CEO in particular, and the board. So I urge you to engage with senior management, with your CEO, and with the board about our requirements here, our expectations. They need to understand their responsibility for this. The main point that I want to leave you with is that the board and management have responsibility for developing an ICAP and for setting target capital and managing the capital position around that target in accordance with their ICAP. And it's critically important that this is done well. Let me finish with a few comments on stress testing. Stress testing is likely to be a very useful tool in developing ICAP and managing capital levels. Stress testing is done in a variety of ways, as many of you will know, but in essence it involves a plausible but quite adverse scenario and an assessment of the impact of that scenario on the business. The stress testing may be relatively simple where each major risk is considered separately, or quite complex when all risks are stressed at once. Stress tests are powerful tools. They help APRA and management and board to understand the capacity of the organisation to cope with the specified scenario, and they also provide insights into vulnerabilities of the company. From this, lessons can be learnt that might lead to changes in strategy or operations, or perhaps to target capital levels. There's also a very useful concept called reverse stress testing, and this is gathering momentum in the regulatory world. This is a little different in that it seeks to identify a scenario that, for example, would cause the company to breach its regulatory capital requirements. And this sort of testing can give fresh insights into vulnerabilities in a way, and this is important, in a way that will be well understood by the board. It goes beyond the complexity of the models and so on and helps them understand the vulnerabilities of the business. So we want to encourage management and boards to consider stress testing as one of the more important weapons in their logic armoury, and to use stress testing accordingly. Okay, now I'm going to hand over to Helen to talk about the next two major themes. So, Helen, over to you.